Now, if that wasn't identifiable enough, hot new track from Tom Morello, new up and comer. You might have heard of Rage Against the Machine, Audio Slave, Social Street Sweeper, Night Watchman. He's played with Bruce Springsteen, and near and dear to my heart, he's also a Cubs fan.
Yes.
Tom Morello's here with us, folks. Yeah. Tom, dive right in, my friend. This is
this is an old-time friend. Yeah, I'm out on tour with the Atlas, touring for the Atlas Underground record, and I've traveled in a lean and mean way. This is my long time ago Telecaster that I needed a guitar. When I learned how to do sort of grunge tuning, which was drop D tuning, I needed a guitar to do it. At the time, I only had like locking nut machines like this, and so I traded my roommate at the time. He had this Telecaster, and I had a 50-watt Marshall head. So we made an even swap, and from that day forward, I started, you know, doing the drop D tuning. This is this guitar was playing on every drop D song I've made. This is my 19th record, the Atlas Underground, and all 19 of them, any song that's in drop D tuning was played on this.
Some of your heaviest riffs, Cochise, yeah. Freedom, Killing a Name. People associate being those the heaviest things.
Yeah,
single coil.
It's all single coil.
Just kind of like yeah, I mean, this, Page style.
Exactly. That's the thing is like to play, and it's one of the things that I think made both Rage, Audioslave, and my riffs wherever they occurred heavy in a different way, in that kind of Jimmy Page way where they're springier and they're funkier and they make the 50,000 people jump up and down more than just sort of a more traditional metal, super metal, double humbucker scene. So this guitar, I mean, for example, his. We can take you through it. There's not much to it. It's like it's fully stocked. I put some stickers on it. It's it allowed me to do a number of things. For example, the riff "Killing the Name" was played on this mm-hmm. guitar. And it just when you do the drop D tuning, it just sort of reconfigures the fretboard in a way and makes you think differently. The dots where the dots are. You put your finger on a dot, it sounds different on when it's drop D.
Yeah.
So I was actually giving a guitar lesson to a fairly accomplished Hollywood guitar player. This is back in the earliest days of Rage Against the Machine, and showed him how to tune a drop D, and in demonstrating it, I did exactly what I just told you, which was it reconfigures the fretboard and makes your fingers go in different places. The riff that I just made up extemporaneously was this. I said, hold on one second. I got my little Radio Shack tape recorder, pressed record on it, tucked it away, continued the lesson, then brought that into Rage rehearsal the next day.
History is made.
There you have it, man. There you have it.
But why did you stop at drop D and not explore further tunings in that regard? Or is it just
there are some drop B songs on some of my records, but then, I'm sort of a traditionalist in a way, and when people started going to drop Z minus, I thought, I'm going to let them have that lane all themselves.
Stay in your lane.
Yeah.
And what strings do you typically use?
I have tens on this to give it a little bit, help it stay in tune
okay.
With the drop D stuff. There's tens on, always tens on this one. And it still gives it enough, bendability up there and to be able to kind of be slinky and dexterous while at the same time holding down here.
Now, do you typically ride in the neck position, or are you kind of...
Always, 100% of the time in the neck position.
Really?
100% of the time.
Why do you feel that?
I don't know, it's just like it felt like... The riffs to me felt like kind of funkier and springier and heavier down there, and on all my guitars, it's always the... unless it's playing the shredding... Yeah, even on this guitar, like when I do the solos, it's always on the rhythm pickup as well.
Huh.
Yeah. Habit, force of habit. Yeah.
And speaking of Atlas Underground, what are songs that maybe people will recognize for this
guitar?
Sure,
sure. Can I?
Yeah, let's do it.
May we be drift
let's
over
explore.
Here? Drift over here. So the this sort of ties the two worlds together. Was I'm a person that is a great believer in like a good riff is a good riff whenever it happens.
Yeah.
For example, like the riff for the opening riff of Bomb Track, that little doot 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 doot. I wrote that when I was 19 years old and a college freshman at Harvard put it on that same Radio Shack tape, and I thought one day this is going to rock people. Similarly, on the Atlas Underground record, there's a song called Vigilante Nocturno, which is played with this guitar, is in drop D tuning, and I wrote that riff during the Evil Empire sessions in Atlanta in 1994. And again, it didn't find sort of fertile ground there.
Yeah.
So I stuck it in my back pocket and knew that one day it would rock people, and that day has come, because it goes like this.
Thank you. it definitely rocks. And that leads me to ask a question, because anything you've played, it's always Tom. It's always, no matter what band or kind of, your voice comes out. So how, using the guitars that we've associated with you years, how do you, have you found and continue to foster your voice?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was sort of being true to myself, and like I love riff rock, sort of, but the riff rock of less so of kind of the Metallicas and the Sepulturas, and more so of the Jimmy Page and the Tony Iommis and the Deep Purples, the Ritchie Blackmores. Like, those riffs were the ones that really spoke to me. So my playing is, I think it's sort of, it's threefold. One, it's that kind of riffage, that sort of 70s riffage. Heavy single note pentatonic bass riffage. The second part is, you know, I practice for, you know, 8 hours a day for a lot of years. Yeah. So I have kind of that, the technique under my fingers. But then it was like in the early days of Rage Against the Machine, I self-identified as the DJ in the band. So it was deconstructing the instrument and looking at it in a very, very different way to create sounds that were not traditional guitar sounds, but that were sounds that were my own.
Were there any DJs going back to that point, was starting the band, that you thought about?
Yeah,
that?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of it was the Public Enemy production, like the Bomb Squad production, which was so sort of disjointed, and it was these crazy collages that they made with samples. But I was like, well, if I could approximate some of that, those rhythms and those textures and those sounds, it would definitely get me out of the rut of trying to sound like Randy Rhoads or Eddie Van Halen or Keith Richards or Chuck Berry.
Yeah. And man, I think with the record, people hopefully have been listening to it. If they're not, this is the cue to do it. It's a Trojan horse of sorts of bringing guitar back.
Yeah.
Because I know with the Night Watchman, you've gone acoustic and non-string before. But with this, it's back to your home.
Yeah,
home
base. The idea was to make a record for 2018 that was an unapologetic rock and roll record, unapologetic guitar record, but it had some of the sonic elements. And the record, I look at it as like it's a sonic conspiracy. And so it's my guitar playing, but it's married with Bass Nectar and Knife Party and Big Boy and Killer Mike and Wu-Tang Clan and Portugal the Man and some friends new and old and really, like Trojan horse, I think is the right way to describe it, to introduce a new generation of people who might otherwise be drawn to only making music on laptops to picking up an electric guitar again and teach them the joys of shredding. We've got a song, you know, one of the songs on the record is that, you know, sort of on alternative radio, and it's the first time in many, many years that there's been a song on alternative radio that had a blessed guitar solo.
we need as much stuff as we can get, my friend. And that speaks to the collaboration you said with Knife Party and then with that track being Battle Sirens and also Rabbit's Revenge. Is like, what was that like collaborating with such EDM based?
Sure. Artists? I mean, well, different ways that have. I'll play a little bit of the Rabbit's Revenge song, which was Bass Nectar, Big Boy, and Killer Mike. So, you know, I set Lauren, is Bass Nectar's name, sat down with him in my studio, and we tried a bunch of different riffs, and nothing was really tickling his fancy. So I was just warming up, and I started played this just. And he said, "What's that?" I said, "That's me warming up." And he said, "Did we record it?" I said, "I think we did." He said, "That's the song. I think we're good."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we just used that as like the main cornerstone, and then he put a huge beat in it, and we sent it over to Big Boy and Killer Mike, and they, you know, rapped on top of it, and that one came together pretty quickly once we found that little, had that good luck for me to be warming up like that.
And that was kind of same kind of synergy that was with like Battle Sirens?
Well, Battle Sirens was different. I mean, each of the songs on this record was made in a different way. Like, I think that when you're in a band and it's good because of the band's chemistry. And together you can create something together that you can't individually. When you're a solo artist and it's good because of the purity of vision. Mm-hmm. And this record, I wanted to have the best of both worlds. Like, I'm the curator of the record. The musical vision and the lyrical overarching vision are mine, but then in each of the individual songs, they can let their freak flag fly, and the chemistry of working with the particular musicians happen. So with Knife Party, I sent them a riff tape. Like, here's seven hot riffs and seven crazy noises and seven squeals and squonks. And I said, use that as the sonic, lose some of the synthesizers and use those as the sonic building blocks to start your production with. And then we went back and forth. So it was really fun. This is The Atlas Underground is my 19th studio record, and one that I want to challenge myself, you know, as a guitarist, as an artist, and as a record maker.
Killer, man. And so I feel like that's enough talk in the telecast.
Yes, we're going to move on over
to the Arm of Homeless.
Sure.
And this was an all-time favorite as also.
This one is been with me for 30 years now.
Man.
And the history of this guitar is spotty. When I first moved to Hollywood, I wanted to have a custom made guitar because Steve Vai and some of my favorites had a custom made guitar. So I went to a guitar shop with my first check that I got from my first real job, and they skinned me. Like, yeah, I mean, it was a huge ripoff. It was probably the worst guitar that I've ever played. And it was my own fault. It's like, I chose the fretboard and I chose this, that, and the other. But I'm not a luthier. I have no idea whether it should be ash or, I have no idea. So I got this stinky guitar. And over the course of the next, feels like in 1986, over the, 87, the course of the next couple years, I tore it apart entirely. The only thing remaining from that original guitar is this piece of wood, right? So it's had a million different necks. This neck I found in a bin, like a throwaway bin at Nadine's Music on Santa Monica Boulevard. It's had different pickups over the years, different whammy pedals, all the electronics are completely different. I put this like fat head thing on the back because I thought it would give it more sustain. It didn't work, but I left it on. And then finally, like I honestly I gave up. I was trying to get a guitar that would be my perfect sound and was banging my head against the wall and just said, I'm gonna stop right now. This is gonna be my guitar and I'm just gonna create with what I've got.
Make it work.
And that was very liberating because it was no longer chasing sounds. It was embracing the sound I had and using that to make music.
And so that's been essentially the way it's set up
this
now.
On all 19 of my records, this guitar features prominently. You know, every show I've ever played, you know, for thousands of shows, this is the guitar. It's been my main guitar for songs that are in standard tuning.
One thing that Perry had mentioned is, do you go through a lot of toggle switches? Because
demonstration here. So, I mean, one of the things, you know, when I was the DJ in Rage Against the Machine, one thing you have to learn to do when you're a DJ is to scratch.
Yeah.
So, at the time when I got this guitar, like the coolest guitars were the Eddie Van Halen ones that had one pickup and one volume knob. So I was stuck with a guitar that had a toggle switch and a bunch of knobs, which was super uncool. So I thought, is there some way to make this work for me?
Yeah.
And the toggle switch thing is, it's basically this pickup is, the volume is turned to zero. So you hear nothing. And then this pickup, it's turned to 10. So when you go between the two, it works as a kill switch, as an on-off switch, right? So if you, you know, create some sort of sound and then rhythmically work the toggle switch like you're picking a guitar, you can create sounds that are reminiscent of a DJ scratching. And then by simply adding something like a slide, which is used in a non-traditional manner. In this way, it's just generating any sort of tone with the guitar can then be manipulated with the toggle switch.
Do you ever mess around with different types of slides or like metals or anything? Or is that
I complain sometimes because they're like too chubby, but this one's pretty good right here. This one's
What about strings on this one?
Strings on this one, it's custom lights. It's 9 to 45. And 9 to 46.
And what's the reason behind that?
The reason behind that is just, it seemed to work better with the locking nut for me.
Okay.
And because I'm not tuning down for this, it provides sort of like a springiness in the... An ease in bending without having the tens on there.
So. Cool. And I assume those are just EMG.
Yeah, they're EMGs. And again, much of the riffage in my career is done on the front one, which is a single coil disguised as a humbucker.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like. And then pretty much strictly for soloing do I go to the other.
Gotcha.
Go to the other one.
Well, I mean, we'll keep you when we go to the pedal board, but
sure.
I do definitely want to talk about the nylon
string
here. That I'm familiar with, like Night Watchman.
Yep.
And obviously, I know that big Woody Guthrie fan.
Yep. So, this is a nylon string guitar that is my main acoustic vehicle. And, you know, I made four solo records under the name The Night Watchman, which are basically, you know, sort of Americana / political folk records. And I've always been a fan of heavy music. And first it was metal, and then it was punk, and then it was hip hop. But then it was sort of later in my listening life that I discovered Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska record, the first couple Dylan records, and dug back to Woody Guthrie and Phil Oakes and people like that, and Steve Earle, and realized that you can make music, like perhaps the heaviest music is often very quiet, and it requires just sort of the right lyrical couplet and the right couple of chords to be devastatingly heavy, you know, as heavy as a wall of Marshall Stacks. Yeah. So that's why I started doing the Night Watchman stuff, which I really loved. And a lot of the songs, you know, throughout my electric career were written on a nylon string acoustic, because living in an apartment in Hollywood, you couldn't exactly, you know, crank up the stack at, you know, 3:15 in the morning when inspiration strikes. So a lot of, you know, a lot of the bit, like for, I mean, this is a song that was written, this was written on a nylon, not this one, but one identical. I remember like coming up with that on the nylon string, again, put it on the Radio Shack recorder, and in my mind, I could just picture like a field of Argentinians jumping up and down that, you know, at some point, like in the dark silence of my little apartment, I knew that that was maybe going to happen one day. So,
what strikes you about the nylon string versus like using standard steel string? Yeah,
really, it was a matter of habit. My girlfriend, who's now my wife, she had a nylon string guitar. That was the one that was in our apartment, and so that was the one that I played, and got so accustomed to the sort of the soft feel of the strings, and so then when I started doing my singer-songwriting, it was the guitar that I wrote my first couple songs on and just kept on from there.
Cool. And then what songs do you play with that?
Yeah, well, some of the songs on the Atlas Underground record, for example, Every Step That I Take, was written, which Matt Schultz from Cage the Elephant, myself, wrote, was written, you know, just sitting around with two acoustic guitars. Like, comes this kind of throbbing EDM rock monster on the record, but it started very much like a campfire jam.
Because the solo on that song, we saw it during Cell Check, but yeah, it's in the record. It's electrified.
Yeah.
To say the least.
We can play that when we go down to the pedals.
Killer. Episode. Well, let's do that.
Sure. Fantastic.
We'll do that, and we'll briefly hit on this Marshall that I know you've had for years.
Yes. So this is this head, again, it was around the same time when I finally gave up on my guitar there, trying to make it the one I wanted, and decided it's going to be the one that I have. I had all of my gear was stolen on a fateful Valentine's Day many years ago, over 30 years ago, and I had a session the next weekend, so I had to go to this shop and just get what they had.
Yeah.
And what they had was a 50-watt Marshall channel switching head and a 4x12 PV cabinet. The time PV cabinet, you know, no offense, PV. PV was like, the first thing I had to do was like unscrew the PV thing on the front so people might mistake it for a Marshall cabinet. You know, because like if you're a Hollywood musician, you couldn't be seen with PV. Anyway, but that I think contributed to the sort of unique sound that it eventually became.
Yeah.
But again, I would spend hours trying to, you know, create a Nuno Betancourt tone or whatever, and failing miserably. Till one day, and you can see on here, you could, if you want to come in at some point. In 1988, I spent two or three hours with that guitar and with this amp head and the PV cabinet, and said, "This is as good as a tone. I'm going to stop banging my head against the wall. This is going to be my tone." I marked the amp. You can see the markings. They're on there. They're on there.
Yeah.
And I never changed them since. I was just like, we're going to be done ever thinking about that or talking about that. This is going to be the tone, and I'm going to make songs with that tone. The end.
Damn. And have you had to do anything to the amp, you know,
occasionally,
I guess maintenance-wise?
You know, I think like occasionally, like my guitar tech might change the tubes and not tell me, you know, probably they don't tell me. but on this, the PV is not with it. It's at home. The PV is not with us because we're sort of traveling light on this Atlas Underground tour. So any 4x12 will approximate the sound. The sound is basically between the head, those guitars, and my fingers.
Well, speaking of that, let's dive into your pedal board.
Sure.
Hear some more of that magic.
Dive on in. Let's get magical. So this is it. basically. These are all the pedal, and this is kind of maybe more than are usually around. So the pedals that I've used for, I mean, the better part of three decades, it's an MXR Phase 90, which I only use for the beginning of Killing in the Name, you know? Like, it's like one. Other than that, it doesn't get turned on. That's it. It's got like, it's like a pinch hitter, it's like a specialist. It comes in. The EQ pedal I use exclusively for boost on songs. So it's from back in the days of playing clubs when you couldn't trust the sound man to know when the guitar solo was going to come. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm going to take that out of your hands. I'm going to be loud when the guitar solo comes. You don't have to worry about that. I'm going to take care of that. So it's set flat, flat and up for that. Then I have two identical delay pedals. One is for, just so I don't have to change the settings so much during the show. One is just sort of the long delay, which accompanies all of the, you know. Your astral pleasure right there. and then the other one is has like, there's only a total of three settings between these two, and this one sort of goes back and forth between this ping pong delay, which
issues with having like notes not sustaining for the finger tapping, because sometimes guys will juice that with a boost pedal
to not have the notes drop out. I always use the only gain is just the gain from the head, you know, which is just pretty substantial. Yeah. I just kind of smack down on it pretty hard there.
Cool.
And then there's the whammy pedal, which is kind of one of the things that really helped me break out of the niche of sounding like a bunch of other players. I never could really wrap my head around rack gear.
Yeah.
And I bought one piece of rack gear and I couldn't even figure out how to plug it in, so I thought that's probably not for me. So when they had a harmonizer in a pedal, I thought, well, perhaps that's something that I could make work. And then I found that in addition to the harmony settings, which, you know, include like the fifth, which is heard on songs such as Know Your Enemy. Like that. It had sort of a bonus little thing was the two octaves up. And that I would just like took great liberties to create sheets of white noise that could be manipulated in a lot of different ways. For example, during the song Bullet in the Head, which goes. And so it really was a matter of just looking at the guitar in a different way and like, okay, I've got a toggle switch and I can make some noise, so maybe something can happen. And then on a more melodic front, in the band Audio Slave, where we had more chord progressions and sort of prettiness going on, be a more sort of soaring solo in Like a Stone went like.
Now I got to go back to the two octave up. Is that something that you would use like on the very beginning, shortly, like You're the Boomerang? in terms of that. Oh, that
yeah, sure.
Harshness.
I don't really remember how to play that one, but yeah.
No, no, but just in terms of
yeah,
like that.
Like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah.
wanted to.
Yeah, yeah. It was a nice sort of arrow to have in the quiver to be able to play, make these kind of, you know, dog's ear piercing, yeah. you know, sheets of white.
That was just stuff. A personal thing because I'm like, if I ever get time, I'm going to ask him that.
Yeah.
So what else is that kind of your three different?
Yeah, yeah. So then there's the short delay, which is written down here so handily. And that, you know, I would, you know, sort of mess around with a. Flat back delay, which provides some options.
Cool. And how do you use the wah?
And so the wah, I mean, I rarely use it in, I mean, sometimes I use it in like the sort of traditional wah, you know. Yeah, sort of traditional shredding, bluesy, wahing ways. But I also found that it provided, like it helped sort of in the scratching area. So when I scratch, I could put the, click on the wah, depress it all the way, and it makes for even more of kind of like a white, noisy, you know. And then you can. Something like that. Another sort of curious wah thing that happens is I found that this is just some sort of crazy electronic magic that occurs. If you take the original Digitech whammy pedal, you turn it on, you set it to one or two octaves up, you turn it on, don't depress it, leave it there. Mm-hmm. You turn your wah-wah pedal on, like that, is it on? You turn it on, you unplug your guitar, make a noise with that, you touch anything to that, and all of a sudden, craziness happens. You don't even need string, you don't even change your strings when you do that. Your strings will last forever.
It's pure experimentation. And the last pedal here is
sure.
You made a remark in the interview you did with PG about a month ago was that this is your version of taking this pedal, putting it in your pedal board, is to take back the sound.
Yeah. This is the Digitech Space Station, which was like sort of a somewhat crappy pedal that they came up with in the aftermath of my first two records.
Yeah.
Where they seem to have gone through the sounds of those records and tried to put them in a pedal they could then sell to people without calling me about that.
And so you're stealing them back.
Is this on? Hey, Brett, is this on? It's on. Yeah. It creates a lot of like extra noise in the line, so we have it like completely separated, and
gotcha.
It's only we hit like the Megatron button when it's time to. What it is, I only use a couple of the settings because I find most of them are pretty unusable. Mm. But there are some that, you know, are pretty cool. Which is, am I on here?
Definitely like sounds
that.
Like you.
Yeah, exactly. That's built in. You don't have to. That'll save you years of practice. Just plug that thing in.
I see that you got Mr. Crowley here. You're a big Randy Rhoads
yeah,
fan.
Yeah,
how
yeah,
do
yeah.
you interpret that song through the set? Or is that you do kind of pretty faithful?
Come to the show to see that one. Yeah. You know what? I'll do it for you. Can we do that? Aaron, are you here? Nope. I can do that for you.
Well, just to say, is it like a faithful recreation, or do you?
No,
put it
no.
Your
I just
own?
Like when I was doing my 8 hours of practice a day. 2 hours that was dedicated to technique, 2 hours was dedicated to theory, 2 hours was dedicated to songwriting and song learning, and then 2 hours was dedicated to improvisation. And one of the things I would do is I would just make long chord progressions of some of my favorite songs and just jam over them endlessly. And one of those was the Mr. Crowley chord progression. So that was one that I
Cool.
Yeah, that we do during the show.
And one last question I got, since you are playing with yourself with tracks behind you, do you miss having a band behind you? In the sense where you
have lots of opportunity to have bands behind. I enjoy it, and this is like the promo tour for Atlas Underground, where it's intimate venues. There's a lot of discussion about sort of my career in the various bands, and then I shred my ass off. In 2019, we're coming back with a proper tour, and there will be band, and it's all going to be happening.
Cool.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you so much for not only bringing a guitar and making it cool in 1991, but still making it cool in 2018 and beyond.
Right on.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much,
Chris
everybody.
Keys, welcome to your guitar.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for watching the latest Rig Rundown. Guess what? Every week, we upload a brand new Rig Rundown to PremierGuitar.com a full week before it's available here on YouTube. So to get your gear fix as soon as humanly possible, go to PremierGuitar.com/Rig Rundown. And while you're there, be sure to sign up to get an email notification so you're the first to know as soon as each week's new Rig Rundown is available. Cheers, see you soon.